This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Living life with Tourette's is not easy. It's not a walk in the park. But as with any other medical condition or even with life itself, it's already complicated. So I would say that to stand out and be different is not something bad.
Of course, life is up and downs, and living with Tourette's is very, very different than a lot of people. And it's just like Anne said, it's a medical condition. I agree with that. And yeah, and it's just living differently.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm Meera Sivasodhi. You just heard from Anne and Lee Ching, who both have Tourette syndrome. Tourette is a neurological condition that causes involuntary movements and vocal sounds called tics. People with Tourette's are often the subject of jokes, even bullying. The condition is still misunderstood and even feared by many. Dr. Lim Chun Young, consultant neurologist and professor of medicine from the University of Malaya, is here with us to help us demystify this condition. Throughout the show, you will continue to hear from Anne and Lee Ching about the challenges of living with Tourette's. Welcome to the show, Dr. Lim. How are you today?
Good, thank you. Thanks for having me again, Meera.
Sure, always a pleasure. Do you want to just go through with us, what is Tourette's syndrome really?
Okay, I think you've provided quite a nice definition of this condition. Basically, Tourette's is a condition where there is the presence of tics. So these are, as you've mentioned, either involuntary movements or involuntary utterances. And in the case of Tourette, these tics have been present at least for a year, and usually the onset is before the age of 18. So typically we see this condition with onset starting in early childhood.
Early childhood, yeah. Not at puberty.
So school-age children.
Okay, do we know what causes it?
So Tourette is now considered a neurological condition, and the understanding about Tourette, I think, as a neurological condition, dates back to about 50 years ago when people recognized that this condition responded to treatment with certain types of medications, so-called neuroleptic medications, which have an effect on blocking dopamine in the brain. So from that, there was an understanding that this is a condition involving some alterations in the neurochemistry of the brain.
So the lack of dopamine, or it's blocking?
Yeah, so the precise problem actually is not well defined, but what these drugs do is, in fact, they block dopamine. So the idea is that in Tourette, there may be a overactivation of dopamine transmission within the brain. This is in contrast to,
Parkinson's.
We've talked about Parkinson's
yes,
disease before,
exactly.
In which the problem is the opposite one, where there is a deficiency of dopamine signaling within the brain. These are related but somewhat different parts of the brain, though.
And we don't know what triggered, because they are not born with Tourette's. Somewhere along the way, this happens.
Yeah. So, again, coming back to this idea of Tourette as a medical condition, is the observation that many of these people who have tics and Tourette syndrome also have a family history of this, either tics or a history of, for example, OCD, obsessive-compulsive disorder. The precise cause for this is not known. Like, I think in many things in medicine, it's multifactorial. So it's a complex combination of probably multiple genetic factors in conjunction with environmental triggers. But we don't really quite understand, you know, precisely what these triggers are.
You know, you just mentioned it's now a neurological condition. It used to be very much psychological back in the day. Did we approach it differently then?
Yeah, well, I guess in the past, you know, with many psychiatric conditions or neuropsychiatric conditions, these were, you know, thought to have primarily a psychological basis, you know, from the psychodynamic underpinnings of psychiatry, you know, with Freud and so on. But I think a lot of the field, you know, even in conditions like depression, bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, increasingly these are thought to have at least some neurochemical basis. And certainly this is true for Tourette syndrome as well.
And do we know how common it is here in Malaysia?
Yeah. So if you look at tics are very common. And people have done surveys, not specifically in Malaysia, but in many countries, where they've looked at this. Some studies even with the researchers going into schools to observe kids in their, you know, day-to-day usual environment. And in some studies, these are as common as 10% or sometimes even more. So tics are very common. But Tourette is, as I said, a condition where the tics have persisted for at least a year, and it involves both movements as well as phonic or vocal tics, sounds. So that's less common, but still thought to have a prevalence of about 1%.
So there could be cases where somebody could develop tics and it could go off, as in, because you said the tics have to have persisted for a year.
That's right.
To be diagnosed as Tourette's.
That's probably quite a common scenario where children of school age develop tics as a manifestation of some problem with brain maturation. But as they get older, the tics either disappear or they improve significantly.
All right. But the general rule for Tourette syndrome is tics persist for a year.
That's right.
That's considered
sort of arbitrary definition that's used to diagnose Tourette syndrome. Correct.
Do these symptoms sort of worsen over time?
So the general tendency, in fact, is for these tics to improve over time. So many patients or children, you will see that by their late teens, the condition has improved significantly on its own. And in fact, it's actually very common to see children being brought in for medical assessment where it's actually not necessarily a problem for the child. And it may be a problem more, you know, for the parents who are very concerned about this. And then I think quite frequently, the problem resolves spontaneously without any specific interventions.
And Anne and Li Ching actually share their experience as children.
I was clinically diagnosed at the age of 9. So being a child, it's very difficult to actually come to terms with it. It was hard to understand why I was treated differently, why my mom came often to school to speak to my teachers, because it's a very unheard of condition, especially here in Malaysia, compared to Western countries where people are more well-versed about this condition. Therefore, I would say it was, I suppose it was just slowly integrated into my life, bit by bit. It's now part of my life and I can't get rid of it, so I have to make the best of it.
I was clinically diagnosed at the age of 14. Yeah, so before 14, my symptoms came at 8. I didn't know what it was. So at first, I thought it was a normal thing. You know, like people do it all the time. So, and then as a kid, I was curious. So I studied people. I observed people. And then I realized, like, no, they don't do these things. Like jerking and then making sounds. And then at some point, I thought, oh, am I possessed or something? Or am I crazy? Then I realized that crazy people don't know whether they're crazy or that's what my mom used to tell me last time. So that's not a very nice thing to say anyway, right?
Dr. Lim, how is Tourette's syndrome diagnosed?
Okay, so it comes back to the definition of Tourette as a condition where there are tics. Movements or motor tics as well as sounds, phonic tics or vocal tics that last at least for a year. So the common thing to see with tics, these are involuntary movements. So the frequent thing you'll see is frequent eye blinking, shoulder shrugging, jerks of the head. And there tends to be an upper body predominance. So head, face and neck, shoulders tend to be preferentially affected, although some patients also have tics involving the legs, for example, stomping or kicking. With vocalizations, they can be simple sounds like grunts, sniffing, coughing, throat clearing, that sort of thing. Or in some cases, they can be more complex. And I think the picture that many people have when they think of Tourette, you know, popularized in the media is the situation where you have someone having involuntary utterances of obscenities and, you know, and curses, that sort of thing. So Tourette is a clinical diagnosis. It's based on the presence of these features. In general, because this is this is a problem with brain function rather than brain structure. It's not something that you'd be able to visualize, for example, with an MRI scan of the brain. So, in fact, in most patients, if the condition is quite typical for Tourette, there are no unusual or unexpected features, we would not usually proceed with further testing in the form of, you know, brain imaging or blood tests and so on. It's usually a clinical diagnosis.
Even an fMRI will not help?
So there are sophisticated scans that look at brain function, and that includes things like fMRI or even PET scans, that have shown abnormalities in brain function in patients with Tourette. And this, again, lends support to the idea that this is a medical rather than, you know, primarily a psychological condition. But these are not tests that are used in clinical practice.
How do you know it's just not a habit? You know, some people have habits they develop, like, you know, twitching of the eye or, you know, shrugging of the shoulder or, you know, I've seen that as well.
Yeah.
They're not considered Tourette syndrome, but sometimes it's just a habit.
Yeah. I think it's a spectrum. And, you know, it's hard to say 100% this is a habit and this is a tick. I think it's a spectrum with a gradation of severity. And, you know, the frequency of manifestation is a consideration as well. I think most of these people we see with these movements do in fact have tics. You know, it's something that they can so many patients with tics can suppress them. Okay, although this is at the cost of a feeling of uneasiness. So patients with tics and Tourette, they have an urge to make these. To make these movements, and if they don't make the movements, there is a, you know, sense of increasing tension that is relieved only once the movement or the sound is performed.
And Anne and Lee Ching speak about that actually.
Previously, I was in luxury retail, and I actually lost my job because of Tourette's. I was quite young that time, so I really did not really understand, but I actually explained to the HR, and my hiring manager actually was conscious about Tourette syndrome, and she knew I had the condition. But after working there for 3 months, the big boss walked around and he just couldn't have me there because they had to protect their image. It was something about lifestyle and image. So he actually instructed the HR to unfairly dismiss me. But this was not the only incident. It happened again in one of my previous jobs. And I was actually working there for 1.5 years. And after that, they actually requested me to leave too. And that was not an easy period of my life. But going through this a couple of times in my life made the process much easier the second time around. And knowing what my rights are, as well as knowing where I stand, and also always telling myself that it's not my fault.
My first job was a sports journalist. Oh wow, that was really tough for me. And I was anxious all the time. I couldn't even sleep during the night because I was anxious about the next day. Mainly about talking to people and sitting in a space where, you know, press conferences I had to attend. So I would sit there and then instead of listening to the speaker, I was controlling my tics.
Yeah, and so, that's a very uncomfortable feeling.
Yeah. I left the job because I felt I can't continue doing this because it's taking a toll on my body and my mental health as well.
The two people you've interviewed have, I think, put it very eloquently. The consequences of tics. So one is that suppression of the tics can be at the cost of, you know, not being able to concentrate. So this frequently can have an effect on school academic performance. In some patients, the tics can cause self-injury. There are some patients, for example, if the tics are quite violent, involving the neck, for example, that can cause injury to the spine or even to the spinal cord, rarely. And of course, we heard about social stigma, which is a very big issue. So social stigma, loss of self-esteem. In some patients who have intrusive tics, you know, vocalizations that can cause conflict as well. So I guess one of the useful things from this kind of forum is to raise awareness of this condition, that this is not something that people are performing on purpose. They're not swearing volitionally. This is not something that is done voluntarily.
We'll come back and find out more about treatment options and how you can actually make up for or suppress those dopamine levels, as Dr. Lim has alluded to, as far as Tourette syndrome is concerned. If you've just joined us, we are discussing this syndrome, which is a neurological condition due to the overproduction of dopamine. When we come back, we'll find out more about this social stigma, as well as, I want to know, Dr. Lim, when parents actually come to you, how do you help them deal with this? It must be quite devastating for them. Coming up next on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm Meera Sivasodhi, Dr. Lim Shin Young, consultant neurologist and professor of medicine from University of Malaya, discussing living with Tourette's. As I just explained earlier on, Tourette's is a neurological condition where people have involuntary movements and vocal sounds called tics, and this, as Dr. Lim earlier spoke about, can develop from early childhood all the way up to the age of 18. When parents come to you when these children present with tics or involuntary movements at home, how do you help them deal with this, Dr. Lim? I mean, it's something these children will have to live with for the rest of their lives, and it's difficult.
Okay, well, first of all, as mentioned, many of these children don't actually have this condition lifelong. So many of them grow out of it. So I think the first thing is reassurance. For many parents, the thing they fear is that there is a very serious neurological problem going on. So the first thing is reassurance that this is common. As I said, about 10% of school age, up to about 10% of school age children can have tics, usually as a temporary phenomenon, and they outgrow it with maturation of the brain. A lot of this, I think, as well has to do with the general level of awareness amongst teachers, amongst peers in school. So, I think if we have more awareness of this problem, then hopefully there will be more acceptance that this is, as discussed, this is not something that is deliberate on the part of the patient, you know, having these tics. So in most situations, actually, because the tics are not severe, we end up usually in discussion with the parent as well as the child. We end up usually electing not to treat the tics and giving this time, for the patient to improve spontaneously. And that usually happens.
And for those who it doesn't happen, what happens then?
So for those in whom the tics are disabling, so whether for example, what we discussed before, causing injury or causing social embarrassment, you know, teasing, difficulties with academic performance. If these issues are significant, then treatment options are available. In brief, there are two major forms of treatment for tics. The first is non-pharmacological, so this means behavioral treatment. So there is a form of CBT or cognitive behavioral therapy, which is a treatment offered by psychologists. And a specific type for Tourette syndrome is called habit reversal therapy, or HRT, in which the patient is trained to have a competing response when the urge to tick occurs. So, for example, instead of performing a head-shaking tick, the patient may be taught to instead put the chin on the chest, that sort of thing.
To do the opposite.
Yeah, or instead of having a vocal tic, the patient may be trained to take deep breaths instead. So this is a treatment that is increasingly suggested by clinicians, but it does require a patient who is cooperative, has motivation, and requires also a reasonable amount of insight, you know, into the condition. So it's not a treatment I think you can offer to very young children. And the other thing is, you know, the availability of this therapy is limited. So you need trained psychologists who are able to administer this treatment. And to my knowledge, this is not a treatment that's widely available in Malaysia.
Usually psychologists are the ones who carry out this sort of treatment.
Then in terms of the medication treatment, so this is usually in the hands of either a neurologist or a neuropsychiatrist. Some psychiatrists also have an interest in Tourette syndrome and do treat Tourette syndrome. So there are a number of types of medications. In general, as mentioned, the most effective type of treatment are neuroleptic medications. So these are, or the other name for these medications are antipsychotic medications. So these are used to treat schizophrenia. And so these treatments can be very effective, but they are not without potential downsides. And so this is why I said that unless the problem is disabling, we would not usually embark on these treatments.
And medication is usually lifelong?
No, not necessarily, but they are frequently used on a long-term basis, right? At least for some months, if not years.
Okay. And what about deep brain stimulation? I know we've spoken about this in relation to Parkinson's disease. Does deep brain stimulation play? Has it got its role in helping people with Tourette syndrome?
So that's a good question. We've talked about DBS or deep brain stimulation as a treatment for a variety of movement disorders, most commonly Parkinson's disease. And this is a treatment now worldwide that has been used for about 30 years and about almost 140,000 patients with various movement disorders, primarily Parkinson's disease, have undergone this treatment, and it can be very effective. DBS for Tourette syndrome is much less well established. There are probably something like 50 to 100 cases that have been published. You know, the experience has been published worldwide by large university centers that are performing this. The brain target that is used for DBS and Tourette syndrome is different from the target that is used in Parkinson's disease. So in Parkinson's, we're talking about the STN or subthalamic nucleus, very deep in the brain. In Tourette, it's the ideal target actually is not well established. It, you know, some centers have used the thalamus, some centers have used the GPI or globus pallidus. These are basically parts of the brain that are involved in control of movements, okay, so-called basal ganglia. So this is a treatment that I think can be considered in cases where the symptoms have been refractory to medication treatment. So severe symptoms that are not responding to usual medication treatment. I'll give you an example. In fact, just last Friday in clinic, I saw a patient for the first time who had been referred to us, a young man who was about 20, and I mean, in a way, very harrowing to see his condition. So the medical officer clerked his case in clinic, and then I was asked to come in as to give a consult. And this chap was basically sitting on the floor of the clinic, facing the wall, and had his arms. So he had restrained himself by putting his arms within his clothes, sitting cross-legged, with the reasoning that if he were to just, you know, release himself, he would end up breaking the furniture and the windows of the room.
Right.
So this was a case where, you know, obviously the tics are very severe in terms of the movements, violent movements with self-injury. A lot of obscenity, swearing, And this is a case where I guess if medication treatment is insufficient to control the symptoms adequately, then DBS could be considered.
And DBS works like a heart pacemaker?
Yeah, it's much like a, the battery is much like a pacemaker, but the wires go into the brain and they modulate brain function.
Okay. People with Tourette's face social challenges, and Anne and Lee Ching sort of speak about that.
Well, theatre has been very understanding with me. So I'm really grateful and really thankful to be in the industry that's very open. Yeah, so I think people may have problems with me sitting in the same theatre space, watching a theatre with me. Some people may have problems with that. I think it shouldn't be a problem. Because it's those kind of people that make people like us take stress. A seat back and stress and
you,
don't want to go
even
out.
More anxious, I suppose.
Yeah.
Because when you're out in the public and you think you're conscious that people are judging, and that's when you get more anxious. So
also, I mean, those kind of people make people like us, you know, don't want to go out. Yeah. Or hide at the corners and then don't want to socialize. I mean, that shouldn't be the way. We should be accepting for all kinds of people.
For example, if we are out in the public, like even in a restaurant, or even when we are taking a flight in the airport. Those are the biggest biggest place where we will always get in trouble, especially flights. Like, for example, I was denied boarding once. I was offloaded from a plane. Yeah, I almost couldn't even fly back to Malaysia because even the doctor in Thailand did not realize what Tourette's condition was. And hence, he had to look up the medical journal. I had to Google it for him. And due to language barrier, he has never heard of this condition before and he thought it was crazy.
What did you think of that? I mean, is the medical fraternity in the know as to what Tourette's syndrome really is? Or
I'm not sure. I suspect that you know, much like what this lady experienced, there's probably still a lot of ignorance about this condition with, you know, amongst the public as well as within the medical fraternity.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not something that is typically taught in medical schools.
Really?
Yeah.
Unless you go into neurology?
Yeah, I think so. You know, it's not. I'm not sure why. It's not something that is usually part of the syllabus, although that's changing.
Mm-hmm.
We've put in some questions.
Yes.
Exam questions for the medical students.
A good thing. I mean, if the medical fraternity is not terribly aware of it, then what more the layperson,
exactly,
isn't it?
Yeah.
What would you say to the layperson about Tourette's syndrome and helping us understand the condition a lot more?
Yeah.
Because it can be disruptive.
It can be. Mm-hmm. I think probably what's important is to recognize that this is involuntary. Okay, so it's these utterances and movements occur as a result of a problem with brain function, and it's not something that the patient is doing on purpose. And I think that's the main thing.
What about
and not to take it personally?
Yeah. And what about their learning experience? I mean, what's the best educational setting for children with Tourette syndrome?
I'm not sure, actually, Mira, whether these people would be better off in a special education setting. I don't think so. I think it would be better if they can be integrated within, you know, a mainstream school, for example, unless there are additional problems. So it is known that patients with Tourette sometimes can have so-called comorbid psychological issues.
Mm-hmm.
The commonest being OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder, and ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. So in these situations, in fact, in some of these patients, these comorbid psychological issues can be more disabling than the tics themselves.
How do you help them manage that?
So this is very much, I think, in the psychology and the psychiatric realm. Again, there are behavioral treatments for these conditions, as well as medication treatments, if the behavioral treatments are insufficient.
Could one be causing the other?
They overlap. So it's, I don't think it's a case that the tics are causing ADHD or vice versa. They overlap. And I think this, again, has to do with the fact that these are conditions affecting the brain, which control movement and emotion, the basal ganglia.
And is Tourette's, we know that it's genetically inherited. There's some amount of genetic link for people who do have Tourette's. I mean, they would be concerned about their future generation sort of inheriting this sort of condition. I mean, should they be too very concerned about it, or how should they be approaching?
Yeah, I think the genetic component or genetic contribution to Tourette is probably quite high, but it's not a one-to-one correspondence, meaning to say that if you have Tourette, it's not inevitable that your children will have this as well. So it's as I mentioned before, it's a multifactorial, multigenetic, polygenic kind of problem with environmental factors as well. So far no specific genetic abnormality has been pinned down as a contributor to Tourette syndrome. But I think in the future we will know more about this.
Okay. And your reassurance to people with Tourette's and to parents of children with the condition, what would that be?
Yeah, so, the bulk of patients we see are those in whom the tics are relatively mild and not causing major disability. And I think in most of these cases, they can be treated with reassurance, education, and holding off medication treatment, which, as mentioned, can have their own side effects as well. So in brief, medications that are used to treat Tourette sometimes can cause sleepiness, they can cause giddiness, depression, metabolic syndrome or weight gain is common with some of these antipsychotic medications. And in rare instances, you can even have what's called tardive syndromes, where, these medications can produce involuntary movements of their own. So this is concerned with, overzealous medication treatment.
So in terms of managing the conditions, we still have a long way to go?
I think so, yeah.
Mm. In understanding it as well,
yeah.
Isn't it?
Yes.
Okay. So besides the involuntary movements, what I'm hearing from you is that they're perfectly normal functioning human beings.
Yeah. The vast majority of patients with Tourette have this as a so-called primary condition, meaning to say that it's not coming as a result of some other brain disease. So it's not a neurodegenerative disease. For example, it's not like Parkinson's disease where over time one expects continued worsening of the condition in the absence of a cure. So with Tourette, usually patients will improve.
And Anne and Li Ching share their hopes and dreams, actually, going forward.
I have a lifelong dream that one day Tourette's will become something very... very
common.
Common, like having a fever, like people are making having tics in the restaurant, and then people would just realize that, oh, and it's Tourette's. And I hope that one day that will happen, but I don't know when.
It's as simple as, she has Tourette's, let's accept her. Mm-hmm. So I think at the end of the day, we're speaking for people who are differently able, not only Tourette syndrome, where we want people to just integrate us into society and accept us as equals, a level playing field.
I suppose that conversation starts now, isn't it, Dr. Lim?
Actually, there is some suggestion that people with Tourette, I guess akin to Asperger syndrome, which is on the spectrum of autistic disorders. Some of these, people are very high achievers. So there is some link. And there is, for example, some literature on, musicians like Mozart have, possibly having had Tourette.
Interesting. Yeah. Thank you very much for sharing your thoughts with us today. That was Dr. Lim Shin Young, consultant neurologist and professor of medicine from University of Malaya, and Anne and Lee Ching, who, you know, two individuals living with Tourette syndrome, sharing their story with us on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.